Blog Talk Radio.
Is it any wonder that I've fallen for you? You're the spell I'm under, and I'm helpless, it's true.
Welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. Everything just fell off my desk. So, how are we doing? Notice I laugh. I don't get upset. I've passed that stage. I'm tired of throwing shovels through walls. I remember a comedian saying, he was an Italian, and he said, we used to have arguments in our house, and one day my father threw a shovel through a wall, and we never had those arguments anymore. Unbelievable. And that's the way life goes, man. My father's saying just before he lowered the boom was, can a guy get peace and quiet around here? And then he would pursue peace and quiet by subduing his enemies, his children. Yeah. What's that? Spare the rod and spoil a child? What do you do when a guy has a hurling stick? You don't know what a hurling stick is. It's a short hockey stick that the Irish used to play a game with a puck, much like the American Indians did with captive heads. Yeah. That's how basketball got started by the Aztecs. You know that, right? They used to throw the heads in a hoop. Yeah, oh, we've always been civilized. So anyway, what's going on today? I was shocked. I listened to Sean Hannity, and he was playing clips from NBC, Nothing But Communists. And there's a guy on there called Ed Schultz. You ever hear this guy? This guy should have his mouth washed out with the military soap. This guy is a real pig in a blanket. He is a real spiteful animal. And that's being kind. And he was talking about Cheney's heart transplant, and he said he should die. Then he nailed Sarah Palin. And he called all the white people racist, like what's his name does, Chris Matthews Rasbanjani. Yeah, if you oppose Obama, you're a racist, according to Chris. You know what the three biggest lies in the world are? The check is in the mail. There's nothing wrong with Alec Baldwin. And Chris Matthews never said the N-word. Yeah, we're in trouble, guys. We're in real trouble. You got a president. Unbelievable. He sold us a bill of goods. We're going to have a unity. Yeah, unity. Guys are killing their wives tonight. They're murdering them in bathtubs and taking them on hikes into the mountains. Unity. You got to be kidding me, man. We're more divided than in the Civil War. But I tell you what, I do notice that the communists are getting, as they tighten up their hold on the government, they're starting to become more brazen. And the word McCarthyism is back. They're using it. That's what they, you know, that's like the race card for communists. And if, like I was watching O'Reilly last night, and he had on the communist that used to work for the Washington Post. Remember the two guys they made heroes out of after they talked to Deep Throat? Remember Deep Throat? The second highest command in the FBI was leaking information on Nixon. Yeah, oh, we're secure. We're secure. And now they're making a movie about WikiLeaks. We have to save the world. We have to reveal all of America's nuclear secrets. Yeah. And if you think that that guy Snowden was doing it for America, then you haven't had any KGB training. Yeah, and the KGB, they just changed the letters. They're still here, guys. They're still here. So I'm reading about Joseph McCarthy, being that McCarthyism is going to be trotted out now by the Communist Party, which used to be the Democrat Party. No, the Democrat Party is now the Republican Party, and they can't wait to exterminate the Tea Party. As a matter of fact, they're watching reruns of Hitler's Night of the Long Knives when he wiped out the brown shirts, his buddies. And this guy, Ed Schultz, I think he's got nude photos in his wallet of Ernst Röhm, who was the head SS guy until Heinrich Himmler, or as I call him, Chuck Schumer, took over. Yeah, oh, man, what a beating we're going to get. You have no idea. We are not ready for anything. You see those guys stalking the mall in Kenya? Huh? Four guys walking. You see all the damage they did? They killed 60 people, men, women, and children. Huh? They didn't say, oh, no, we can't do that. Huh? Oh, there might be a mosque nearby. We can't do that. No, if you were laying on the floor looking for mercy, you got a bullet. And you know what? 50 malls in America one day will experience the same thing. And then it still won't reach the magic number. You know when you'll know we've reached the magic number? When the military calls for the reinstatement of the neutron bomb. And then you'll know we're getting serious. Okay, so let's see what this says. I'm reading about Joe McCarthy, and I just wanted to give you a little intro, because when you hear guys using the word McCarthyite, they will ask you, if you ask them, what do you know about Joe McCarthy, they know nothing. They only know what their communist professor told them. And what do you know about McCarthy? He was a drunk, and he had fake lists of people that he destroyed, and that he hated Hollywood. So, this gentleman who wrote his book on McCarthy, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies, by M. Stanton Evans. And this book, let me see how many, 600 pages. And this is chapter 1, The Enemy of the People. Though he's been dead and gone since 1957, Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, lives on in American legend with remarkable staying power, unmatched by other notable figures of his day. Not that Presidents Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, two eminent critics of McCarthy in the 50s, are forgotten. It's just that they don't come up all the time in squabbles of the modern era. Joe McCarthy does, and then some. Scarcely a week goes by, it seems, without some press reference to McCarthy and his anti-communist crusading. The ism that he spawned and the harm he supposedly inflicted on the nation. Books and media retrospectives in which he is featured have been many. Any obituary of anybody involved in the security battles of our domestic Cold War is bound to have some mention of McCarthy. Noticed on TV the other night, the little boys and girls in school getting under the desks, and they're practicing earthquake protection. That's the guys. The real guys is it's going to be lockdown time because terrorists are in the building. And one day in 50 malls in 50 states, these Sudanese and Somalis are going to show up, and they're going to execute a lot of people. And you know what? It won't be enough to move the American people to settle this once and for all. When the towers came down, I asked, what's the magic number? As soon as those towers hit the ground, the communist media was out showing Harmony movies. We're all Americans, and they showed Al-Qaeda wearing policemen's uniforms. We're all Americans. Everybody sing Kumbaya. Yeah. And you know what I said? What's the magic number? It's not 3,000. It's not 10,000. You know what the magic number is for America to go back and put on its war shirt? It's going to be 1,000,000. So any obituary of anybody involved in the security battles of our domestic Cold War is bound to have some mention of McCarthy. He's invoked also when new liberty disputes arise. Also in grave warnings that unless we're careful, the dread McCarthy scourge will once more be upon us. The reasons for all this McCarthyana are well known and don't need much explaining. McCarthy's alleged stock in trade was spreading hysteria about an ersatz internal communist threat and smearing innocent people as subversives without a shred of fact to go on. Did you see Robert Redford playing the race card? Yeah, Robert Redford is a communist. In particular, it said he launched wild, unsupported charges against employees of the U.S. State Department. U.S. State Department has been loaded with communists since the 1940s, and it's still loaded with communists. And if you don't believe me, ask what happened in Fallujah when they sent the Marines in to be chopped up, and halfway through the battle, they called it off and brought them back out while they negotiated and lost the negotiations and sent the Marines back in to get chopped up again. And that's your State Department. They should be locked up in the event of a war. The lives of hapless victims who never got a chance to answer, lying in headline-grabbing accusations, were the supposed essence of his method. The fearsome image of McCarthy has been driven home through years of repetition. Everybody that goes to college is brainwashed. I don't care what college. You can go to a Catholic college. You're getting brainwashed. The communists have infiltrated all the universities in the country. Very few stand for freedom. And there was a girl on Hannity today. And I think she's a high school girl, and she's conservative, and her teacher was berating her and putting her down for her beliefs, which could also be in Christianity. And, Oh, no, I think it was Rush Limbaugh she was on. It was Rush Limbaugh. And he was giving a points of encouragement and said not to feel alone because you're not alone. And that isn't, when I went to school, you could present opposite opinions and the teacher never got involved or took sides. The teacher let a dialogue prevail. But apparently in communist schools today, brainwashing is a big feature. And wait till they get the little ones in preschool. Wait till they wipe out the last vestiges of freedom in a child's mind. This fearsome image of McCarthy has been driven home through years of repetition with little, if any, countervailing comment. Whole generations have come of age hearing nothing else about him. Assume that they are what they are told is true and have no cause to doubt it. In this respect as well, the McCarthy case is somewhat distinctive. Other public figures have been savagely treated in their lifetimes, but enjoyed a bit of historical comeback later. To look no further than office holders with various degrees of political kinship to McCarthy. Such revelations have occurred with Presidents Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and even with Senator Barry Goldwater, the conservative champion of the 60s, whose media image in his prime most resembled treatment of McCarthy. For a junior senator from Wisconsin, however, there has been no redemption. On the contrary, with the passing of the years and departure from the scene of people who knew anything about him, the negatives are more pronounced than ever. He had a pretty bad press when he was alive, but that press is infinitely worse today. Without Fox, there's no freedom. Fox is the only one left that is trying to get to the truth. Back then, he had at least some supporters in book writing and journalistic circles who set forth a different version of the story. But most of these people are gone as well, or their early work neglected, while defenders of McCarthy in the academic media world today are so microscopically few as to be practically non-existent. So deeply etched is the malign image of McCarthy that the ism linked to his name is now a standard feature of the language, defined in all the dictionaries as a great evil, and routinely used this way by people accusing others of low-down tactics. Nothing could better illustrate the point than the conservatives who think their opponents are making baseless charges are apt to complain about McCarthyism of the left. This is immortality of a sort, but not the sort anyone aspires to, that the utter and eternal demonization, that one man should be so vilified for such a lengthy stretch of time would seem strange, except that issues are at stake much larger than the doings of a single politician, however wayward. If McCarthy had killed someone during a spree of drunken driving or been caught in adultery with a student intern, he would have been denounced and gone into the history books as a scoundrel, or maybe not. But he wouldn't have been rhetorically embalmed, placed on exhibit as an ism, and have his effigy dragged around the public square forever after. All too obviously, such nonstop derogation had occurred, not just to blacken the memory of an individual, but to serve a broader purpose. Amen. McCarthy's literary and journalistic folks indeed have made the point explicit. He is treated this way, they tell us, because he crystallized an impulse and a cause that far exceeded his personal failings. He stood for a much wider evil than that swept the nation at mid-century, a Red Scare. That Red Scare was there, and it is here today. Just look at your president. A Red Scare allegedly fertile of many horrors. In a siege of mass paranoia, it said innocent people were hounded out of public life, fired from jobs, and otherwise made to suffer as agents of a fantastic plot that existed only in the fevered brains of know-nothings and vigilantes. Beware of people who use the term vigilante. And McCarthyism. They are probably vigilantes and communists. As McCarthy was the main avatar of this delusion, continuing harping on his crimes is essential to make sure nothing of this dreadful nature will ever be allowed to happen again. That's when they started to put the muzzle on the American people. The pervasiveness of this McCarthy image is its most conspicuous feature. Running a close second, however, is the fact that people who talk and write about him in this way, generally speaking, and this is the truth, know little of McCarthy. Every one of these communist-educated fools, useful idiots, and bad-intentioned people use the word McCarthyism and have no idea what McCarthyism is. And they know little of McCarthy and would be hard-pressed to back their view with plausible specifics, or indeed with anything whatever. The main exceptions to this rule are the relative handful of writers, perhaps a dozen, who do know something of McCarthy and have published harshly critical books about him, often used as sources by journalists and other authors. While there are occasional variations, all these treatments are pretty much the same in substance, and their aggregate impact in conveying a baleful image of McCarthy has been accordingly immense. In the established version of the story, as told by these writers, McCarthy began his ill-omened anti-Red crusade with a series of mendacious speeches in February of 1950, then enlarged on these in Senate hearings conducted by Senator Millard Tidings, Democrat of Maryland, that began the following month. The essence of McCarthy charges was that the State Department and other agencies of the U.S. government had been infiltrated by Soviet agents, members of the Communist Party, and their fellow travelers, and that officials supposedly guarding against this danger had first let it happen, then covered up the facts about it. In these early speeches, McCarthy recited what he said were lists of communist security suspects, mostly anonymous, some identified by name as examples of the infiltration problem. These statements triggered fierce disputes before the Tidings panel, in the press, and in public forums throughout the country. McCarthy's charges were denounced as outrageous lies by President Truman, other prominent politicians, the State Department, media pundits, academics, civic leaders, and a vast array of other critics. At the end of this initial go-around, we're told McCarthy's charges proved to be completely baseless. The relevant data, as conveyed by Tidings and since reprised by countless others, showed not only that McCarthy's charges of subversion were false, but he lied about everything else from start to finish. He didn't have any lists of communists or loyalty suspects, had constantly changed his numbers and other aspects of his story, didn't have inside information sources as he claimed, and otherwise deceived the Senate and the country. The whole thing was a fraud and a hoax, and the American people could rest assured that charges of massive communist penetration of the State Department were fear-mongering nonsense. In the conventional treatment, this opening McCarthy battle was the template for all that followed. Though discredited in this first encounter, he would simply forge ahead by making other, even wilder charges, smearing other victims and spreading more havoc. The rampage would continue unabated until the Army-McCarthy hearings of 1954 and censure proceedings in the Senate a few months later, when he would be condemned in an official action of his colleagues. McCarthy was at last brought low in these final struggles, destroyed by his own excesses. Such was the mad career of Joe McCarthy, such was his dismal end, and good riddance to him. Thus, in brief compass, the universally accepted version of the tale set forth in all the usual biographies and histories of the era, and recited around the media campfires late at night as standard lore about McCarthy. Few episodes are limed more clearly in the chronicles of the Cold War, or more incessantly repeated. Yet despite its canonical status, as shall be seen, there are numerous problems with this telling of the story. For a moment, the main point to be noted is further modulation of the ignorance factor affecting not only members of the general public, who admittedly don't know much about McCarthy, but also the historians, biographers who have made him the object of their study. As it turns out, despite the many certitudes they express about McCarthy and his cases, these learned gentry, in some respects, are as innocent of the facts of record as are their trusted readers. Astonishing as it may seem, very little has been known by historians or anyone else about the vast majority of McCarthy's suspects, the security practices of the State Department in 1950, or communist penetration of the government when he made his charges. This strange epistemological problem stemmed from several causes, the most obvious of which was the most of the McCarthy cases given to the Senate were presented in anonymous fashion and would remain that way for years thereafter. This made it impossible for outside observers to know who the suspects were or whether they were even in the State Department, much less whether their hypothetical presence there posed any kind of danger. Aggravating this knowledge gap was secrecy measures that affected virtually every other aspect of the struggle. So, did you see that IRS chief who defended herself and then pled the Fifth Amendment? What was her name, Levin? Did you see the forest ranger who's in charge of all of the public parks? What do those two people have in common? The sneer. They have the same sneer as they respond to questions by the Congress. Aggravating this knowledge gap, the guy, Trey Gowdy, he wanted to know how Occupy Wall Street was given a pass for 100 days, laying in the gutter and pooping on police cars and smoking weed, and veterans who fought in World War II couldn't even take a picture in Normandy of the 9,000 crosses that are there. Aggravating this knowledge gap were secrecy measures that affected virtually every other aspect of the struggle. Some of this was inherent in the super confidential nature of the subject, but a great deal of it was merely willful. State Department security records were unavailable for public viewing, but also, for the most part, terra incognita to Congress. Efforts by congressional committee to obtain such records ran into countless roadblocks, foremost among them stringent secrecy orders handed down by Harry Truman. I got to tell you, I love Harry Truman. Harry Truman had two big Liberty Bells, and he took no crap. And he was, to me, he was the last Democrat before the Democrat Party went communist. And there's two things that, three things, three, four sayings of Harry Truman that I admire. One is, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. One is, when he learned of a man's infidelity to his wife, he said, if a man can't be faithful to his family, how can he be faithful to his country? And the buck stops here was another one. And the last one that I enjoy the most, this is when they call the roll in Congress, they don't know whether to answer present or not guilty. But he put the kibosh on McCarthy. I didn't know that. I'm learning it as I read it to you. Aggravating this knowledge gap were secrecy measures that affected virtually every other aspect of the struggle. Efforts by congressional committees to obtain such records ran into countless roadblocks. Less accessible yet were records of the FBI, whose investigations were the ultimate source of nearly all such data on State Department or other cases of like nature. Did you ever notice that when the communist community wants to smear somebody, they label them gay? You ever notice that? The same ones who say that they're for gay rights and gay marriage. But when they want to take somebody down, the first thing they do is they label them gay. They've labeled President Lincoln as gay. They've labeled Cardinal Spellman as gay. They've labeled Father Michael Judge on 911 to destroy his image as gay. And the last one that they got, J. Edgar Hoover, they labeled him as gay. The same people that pretend to stand up before gays, when they want to eliminate somebody, they label them gay. Think about that next time you hear somebody bring out that, trot out that label. Given all these secrecy issues, it's apparent that virtually no one other than the people physically controlling the secret records really knew much about security affairs at state or the facts about McCarthy's cases. How then was it possible to make categorical statements about the bogus nature of his charges? And on what basis was it decided that no problem of communist penetration existed? Jimmy from Brooklyn will tell you there were communists that had the ear of Abraham Lincoln. Communism goes back to Germany. These were daunting questions for which a variety of complex responses would be invented. Generally speaking, however, there was one simple overriding answer that for many in media academic circles resolved all such knowledge issues. McCarthy's charges of vast Soviet conspiracy and communist infiltration were so far out, so alien to the experience of most people, as to defy all credence. That being so, the denials of the Truman administration and findings of the Tidings Panel seemed to carry decisive weight, though nobody could get the specifics on which these were founded. As this not-to-worry version matched what many observers thought to start with, a lack of definite information wasn't seen as a huge problem. Luckily, in recent years, the state of our knowledge about such topics has changed in dramatic fashion and greatly for the better. Things known only to a handful of people circa 1950 are now accessible to journalists and scholars, as many formerly secret records have been made public and certain long-lost documents have surfaced. Most notably, with the fall of the Soviet Empire, records from some of the communist archives have become available to outside researchers. Likewise, information from our own formerly confidential files has become in some measure open to inspection. These new sources supply a wealth of information about what was actually going on 50 or 60 years ago in the dark back alleys of the Cold War. The most widely noted of these new disclosures are the so-called Venona Papers. In possession of the U.S. government since World War II, but made available to the public only in 1995, these are coded messages exchanged between the intelligence bosses in the Kremlin and their missives. U.S. Army cryptologists succeeded in breaking the code in which they were embedded, and by a painstaking process was able to figure out the meaning of many cables and the matters they pertain to. In substantial part, the Venona messages dealt with efforts of the Soviet global apparatus. Global. The fourth largest party in Iraq is the Communist Party. Global. Remember global. Later known as the KGB and other Red Intelligence units to penetrate the U.S. government to engage in spying and other species of subversion. Did you ever see the documentary on criminals in Russian prisons? Did you ever see it? You should see it. Because one day you may be a criminal in a Russian prison. And you should see it. When they open up a cell for one guy, three guys go in and get him. He has to be bent over. He cannot stand up straight. And wherever they take him, he has to walk bent over. And three guys take him and one dog. Ready to eat him. Yet a guy named Louis Pepe in a Manhattan federal jail was assigned to guard two Al-Qaeda who were responsible for the 1993 Clinton attack on the World Trade Center. And one of them had gotten a hairbrush that he bought at the commissary. Both were allowed to be in the same cell, and they stabbed Pepe in the eye with the sharpened hairbrush right up into his brain. And today he can't see. He sits in a dark room. He has convulsions. And the videotape that recorded all of the struggle as Pepe was overpowered, disappeared. And then you go see what the Russians do when they handle one prisoner. And when Pepe wanted to testify at the trial of the two guys who tried to kill him, the judge would not allow it. A woman judge who was probably a communist and a jihad sympathizer. In substantial part, the Venona messages dealt with efforts of the Soviet global apparatus, later known as the KGB. And Jimmy from Brooklyn says, who studied communism since the Bolshevik Revolution and is first and foremost America's greatest expert on communism, but can't get listened to unless you catch him on a talk show on a Sunday like Bob Grant, who Bob Grant is gone now, has been gone for about 5-6 weeks. But Jimmy was always there for the last 10 minutes, and he would tell you about the murder of 10 million Ukrainians or anything else you wanted to know about the evil of communism. He will tell you that Al-Zawahiri is a Soviet agent. That's the number two man in Al-Qaeda, now the number one man, was trained in the Soviet Union. We are living in a Hollywood world fighting make-believe enemies from other planets and winning. In substantial part, Venona messages dealt with the efforts of the Soviet global apparatus. Numerous cables back and forth concern these topics and also provide considerable information about the identities of communist agents in the United States then working on behalf of Moscow. Now, what does it mean if you work on behalf of Moscow? Are you a sympathizer? Well, that means you're a real dedicated communist if you're a sympathizer. Are you a sympathizer taking a paycheck? Oh, you're a working communist, like Frank Marshall Davis, who tutored young Obama bin Laden. This intel was shared by the Army with the FBI in long-running super-secret project to track, counter, and ultimately break certain of the Soviet and networks. A second major source of information is the sizable cache of data from the vaults of the former Soviet Union and various of its satellite states. There's a book that Jimmy introduced me to called Red Cocaine and Satellite States Like Romania and Czechoslovakia, Their Soviet Agents Paved the way for the distribution of narcotics into the United States. And in the 1930s, Mao Zedong was growing poppies to hook American kids in the 1930s. When the communists were toppled from power in these countries, these records include extensive data on the activities of the KGB, the Soviet Military Intelligence Service, the GRU, and correlative doings of the Communist International Comintern, the World Wide Web of Communist Parties and controlled front groups that took marching orders from the Kremlin. Such records have been amplified by the memoirs of former intelligence officers in the USSR, Red China, and other communist nations, plus a handful of revelations from their confreres in the United States and the United Kingdom. United Kingdom. You know what? I was totally disillusioned when Winston Churchill, who put his everything into beating Hitler, ran for office and the Labor Party threw him out. You know, it's like the gunfighter that the town brings in to stop crime. And when he stops crime, they tell him, could you move on now because you're giving us a bad image. Yeah, we need Westerns back. Kids have to have role models. Right now, all they have is Dracula. Yet another, and wait till you see this this Halloween. Wait till you see the devil worship on Halloween. Yet another important source of information, in some ways the most important, is the huge, formerly secret counterintelligence archive of the FBI, which was closely tracking communist and pro-communist activities in the United States well before the advent of the Cold War. These records, running to hundreds of thousands of pages, include agent reports, surveillance files, data from wiretaps and informants, and memoranda that synthesize the Bureau's major findings on its cases. These materials have become in part available in recent decades through the Freedom of Information requests and legal actions. And once again, let me mention, Snowden is a KGB agent. That's my personal belief, that he has no love for this country, just like our president. There are still, your president, he's no longer mine, I disown him. There are still other sources to be noted, but these are the main ones, and what they reveal about the clandestine Cold War record is remarkably consistent. Severally and jointly, all of them tell us that the Soviet Union was running a worldwide espionage and influence operation aimed at infiltrating the societies and governments of the West. These efforts were geared to obtaining diplomatic and other official information useful to the Kremlin, securing weapons, technology, and data, acquiring industrial know-how, and influencing the policies of target nations in favor of the Soviet interest. In the United States specifically, there was indeed an extensive Soviet effort to penetrate our institutions for all these reasons. And this one was in many ways successful. Also confirmed by the new materials is something known from other sources, but frequently contested, that the Communist Party, USA, was a faithful creature of the Soviet Union. Far from being more indigenous radicals working for peace and social justice, always the front. As sometimes argued, the party and its members were subservient tools of Moscow, and those who weren't subservient didn't stay very long as members. The party was funded by the USSR. Funded, that means they sent money and paid people, cash in hand, sent its delegates to Russia to be vetted and receive instructions, and was, withal, a functioning part of the Kremlin apparatus, enmeshed in spying, policy sabotage, like supporting Chiang Kai-shek, and not supporting Chiang Kai-shek and supporting Mao Zedong, and disinformation projects at the behest of Stalin and his agents. I'm going to take a break. Just want to give you a little intro. The caveman in the sewer. Okay, I'm going to go to a tune. I come back, I'll read a little bit more because you've been good. And you'll be an expert on communism if you stick with our show. So what do we got here? They brought me back. I'm going to get a tune. You want to hear about Frankie Lane and the Ghost Riders in the Sky? Or you want something a little melancholy? We'll do Frank Sinatra.
I have dreamed that your arms are lovely, and I have dreamed what a joy you'll be. I have dreamed every word you whisper when you're close, close to me. How you look in the glow of evening. I have dreamed and enjoyed the view. In these dreams I've loved you so, that by now I think I know what it's like to be loved by you.
None of this necessarily means McCarthy was right about specific issues or individuals, which is a separate matter. It would have been possible for him to have had a bigger picture, right, more or less, but to have erred as to details, a formula sometimes heard in discussion of these topics. What the disclosures do mean is that the whole question of his cases needs to be reexamined in the light of new information and cannot be dismissed out of hand with sweeping statements about the absurdity of the larger thesis. However, there has to date been no revelation of McCarthy's cases or effort to reassess his reputation based on the new disclosures. Despite occasional suggestions that he might have been onto something, the standard treatment of the McCarthy and his charges rolls on today as vigorously as ever. Indeed, the usual negative view not only prevails, but is reinforced in some excellent studies of Benona, the Soviet archival sources, and other now available records. These comments are usually dicta, without much indication that the authors have made any particular study of McCarthy. To all appearances, these writers have simply rephrased the usual version of the story before proceeding on to the main business of their own researches. Such reluctance to tackle the McCarthy question in the light of the new information may seem odd, but is understandable in context. McCarthyism is the third rail of the Cold War historiography and of our political discourse in general, and any contact with it could prove fatal to writers trying to get their work accepted in academic or mainstream media circles. It's hard enough trying to rewrite the larger history of the East-West struggle and of pro-communist infiltration on the home front without the extra burden, God forbid, of reassessing the untouchable likes of Joe McCarthy. In attempting such reassessment here, we are fortunate that still other records are now also available for viewing. The most significant of these are several tranches of McCarthy papers that by some miracle have survived the decades, including lists naming his anonymous suspects, backup files pertaining to these, and related data on other of his cases. In addition, there is a large amount of information on the McCarthy suspects strewn throughout the government records of the FBI. Other useful databases include the personal files of two of McCarthy's main antagonists in the Senate, Maryland's Millard Tidings and Connecticut's William Benton, two states which are now a communist. The Tiding, I use the word communist like butter on bread, so don't be alarmed if it doesn't tickle your fancy. Any attempted reevaluation of McCarthy and his charges is, of course, very much a matter of specifics, a great number of which, despite lacunae in the records, can be extracted from these sources, and while no summary can possibly do justice to the complex reality of the story, a brief synopsis of what happened on security matters in the federal government before the advent of McCarthy may be helpful in seeing how the infiltration problem came to be and produced the ferocious battles that rocked the country in the 1950s. I was in grammar school, so it was way over my head. But I remember my father and my uncle very intently paying attention to what was going on. By far, the most important factor in this sequence was the political astigmatism that prevailed in official circles beginning in the early to mid-1930s and extending with one notable hiatus up through the end of World War II. In this roughly 10-year span, communist entry into the federal government was typically viewed as no big deal and was thus a relatively easy matter for the comrades to accomplish. Because of the ideological atmospherics of the Depression and the war years, few U.S. officials seem to be concerned about such penetration, though there were some nominal safeguards against it, and in certain instances it was actively encouraged. The communists and their fellow travelers were prompt to take advantage of these conditions. That's where the problems reflected in Venona and other intelligent archives came from. While many of the federal government were blithely ignorant of such infiltration, do you think that we're aware of such infiltration today? We are not as bright as the people in the 30s and the 40s. We are not as aware. Because we're all watching Dancing with the Communists. While many of the federal government were blithely ignorant of such infiltration or considered it of small importance, there were investigative agencies that saw it in a different light. One such was the House Committee of Un-American Activities, which has been shut down by the communists. Or pro-communist penetration of federal programs and departments. Another was the federal FBI, which has been totally discredited. And the way they did it, they made a movie, Hollywood, the hotbed of communism, and made a movie showing J. Edgar Hoover as a demented person. Yeah. Another was the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which also began tracking the comrades closely at this era. From the early 1940s onward, the FBI picked up on numerous attempts by the Communist Party and Soviet agents to infiltrate official agencies and programs, there to engage in theft of secrets, policy sabotage, and pro-Red propaganda. From these investigations, the Bureau assembled a huge mass. By the way, did you know that 70 members of Congress, probably all Democrats, are members of the Socialist Party? They're listed. If you go to the Socialist Party website, they will list the 70 members they have in Congress. From their investigations, the Bureau assembled a huge mass of data about the security problem. The places where it was most acute and the considerable list of suspects on the federal payroll. Beginning in 1942, innumerable FBI reports about these matters were presented to high officials, naming identified Soviet agents, Communist Party members, fellow travelers in a host of federal agencies, Though the information was extensive, now Obama just brings them in and makes them czars. Though the information was extensive, nothing much was done about it at the time or for some while to follow. In many instances, the Bureau reports were challenged or ignored, and others dealt with in a hesitant manner. In few cases, there were decisive action. All these responses would be manifest in the U.S. State Department, which inherited via post-war merger hundreds of cases that had developed in the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. Julia Childs, the famous baker, cook, was in the OSS. Office of War Information and other wartime units where security was especially lax and the penetration most extensive. Isn't that what's happening today? Wherever we're lax, we take a beating, like in Benghazi. As the majority of the suspects who turned up at State were alumni of the wartime bureaus. Security officials in the department were uncertain how to deal with this enormous problem, divided in their views about it, and often deadlocked on handling cases. The net outcome was a series of subliminal halfway measures that got rid of some of the most egregious suspects, but left still others on the payroll. Inevitably, information about all this would make its way to Congress. In the period 1946 to 1948, several flagrant security cases at State and elsewhere became known to members of the House and the Senate, who exerted pressure behind the scenes to have some of the most obvious suspects ousted. There then followed a series of congressional investigations, the most famous, the Hiss Chambers case, that surfaced in the summer of 1948. At this point, however, congressional efforts to learn more about the problem would be stalled out by secrecy orders from President Truman, denying FBI and other executive data on security problems to members of Congress. Investigation of State Department and other cases were accordingly stymied, and the whole matter was left hanging behind the veil of omerta and denial. By accident of circumstance and timing, all these combustionable elements would come together and reach their flashpoint with the arrival on the scene of the virtually unknown Senator Joseph McCarthy in the winter of 1950. As the records clearly show, his list of cases and much of his information about subversion in the federal government were derived from rosters previously put together by the FBI, State Department security screeners, and some of his congressional colleagues. In most cases, the dossiers had simply been sitting there for 2 years or more when McCarthy came along and found them. Likewise, the secrecy policy that shrouded the facts about the cases and would be a huge McCarthy issue had long been a grievance to Congress. McCarthy thus touched off an explosion that had been years in the making. In so doing, he blew the lid off of some major security cases, foremost among them the long-buried Amerasia scandal, in which hundreds of official documents had been funneled to this pro-communist publication and the facts about the matter hidden from the public. Linked to this were still other cases tied to events in Asia and the Far East Division of the State Department, which harbored many of McCarthy's suspects. As all this followed closely in the wake of the communist takeover of China in late 1949, McCarthy's charges of pro-Red infiltration occurred at the same time when the American people were asking questions about that debacle and the issue of China was front and center. Still, other aspects of McCarthy's timing would give his charges even greater traction. A few weeks before the initial McCarthy speeches on the infiltration problem, Alger Hiss had been found guilty of lying about his connection to former Soviet espionage courier Whitaker Chambers. The Hiss verdict convinced large sectors of the public, if not the intelligentsia, that there had indeed been Soviet infiltration of the State Department, contra many denials and obfuscations. And while anti-McCarthy spokesmen would treat Hiss as a mere unfortunate aberration, the thought occurred to others that if there had been one Soviet agent on the payroll at the state, there might have well been more than one. You know what they say about rats in New York? If you see one, there's a million. Adding up the buildup of concern about security matters was the case of Judith Copeland, an employee of the Justice Department arrested in 1949 for passing secret data to Soviet official Valentin Gubichev. Early in 1950, also contemporaneous with the verdict in the Hiss case, nuclear science Klaus Fuchs would, under tough questioning in England, confess that he had been an atom spy for Moscow. And although the case was a British legal matter, it had dire implications for the United States, as Fuchs had spent considerable time at America's secret nuclear project in Los Alamos in New Mexico. Jimmy from Brooklyn says that the Soviets had so many cells inside Los Alamos that they were spying on each other, not knowing the other was also a Soviet cell. And although the case was a British legal matter, it had dire implications. It would prove to be one of the many instances in which U.S. and British security woes crisscrossed and interacted. at the first Senate hearings provided by McCarthy, as the first Senate hearings provided by McCarthy neared their conclusion in the summer of 1950, there would occur an even more traumatic event that underscored his message. In late June, the armies of communist North Korea launched an invasion of the non-communist South. So here's Bruce Springsteen singing Born in the USA. He should change that tune to Buried in the USA because he's promoting communism. We were sent to Vietnam to kill the yellow men. We were sent to Vietnam to save South Vietnam, who is also made up of yellow men. So, having said that, Bruce Springsteen sucks. He's Barbra Streisand in dungarees. At the first Senate hearings provoked by McCarthy, people from New Jersey are crazy. They vote all the wrong people. They love all the wrong people. Who loves Bruce Springsteen? Who loves him? The governor. What does that tell you? What does that tell you? I used to be an American. I used to be for America, and now I'm against it. That's John Kerry. Yeah, he was never for America. He was for John Kerry. Korea launched an invasion of the North, a non-communist South, and in a matter of days, the United States would be embroiled in a shooting war with the Reds of Asia. Short-term, the shock of the invasion eclipsed McCarthy in the headlines and showcased President Truman in the communist fighting guise, quite different from earlier U.S. policy in the region. Otherwise, the war served to make McCarthy's charges even more salient. Equally important was what had been merely a Cold War was now an armed open conflict, an anti-communist feeling in the country, not unnaturally, ran high. While anti-communist per se was McCarthy's central issue, the secrecy question would be from the beginning a strong subdominant theme. And crucial to the story, I'm saving you money, you don't have to buy the book. I'm sure I'm not helping the author, though. New Deal efforts to obscure the problem to the felonious cover-up of Amerasia. Too many other topics touched on the conventional histories, in nearly all such cases, there is a jarring contrast between the accepted version of events and what is actually in the records. The reason for all this secrecy was several, but one motive that led all the rest stands out plainly from the data. Officials at the White House, State Department, and elsewhere in the government weren't eager to have the unvarnished facts about the level of communist penetration on their watch and their failure to do much about it set forth clearly before the nation. Joe McCarthy, by some quirk of fate, managed to focus the blazing spotlight of public notice on these issues in a way nobody had ever done before him. He and his charges were thus viewed in certain quarters as a serious menace to be dealt with quickly and in a most decisive fashion, and so in fact that they would be. So, that was chapter one. And if you tune in maybe tomorrow, we'll do a chapter two. We will close out. Let me see if we got something patriotic we can close out with. Hands up. Yeah, you're going to come out of your house one day and Russian tanks are going to be turning the corner and Chinese troops are going to be directing traffic. And you're going to wonder how could this be? We're the land of the free. Yeah, not anymore. They're destroying the Constitution. Well, yeah, here's one we're going to do. We'll close with this one. I'm dedicating this to all who serve. I'm dedicating this to all the fathers who have to go overseas, that less than 1% who puts their life on the line so you and I can complain about the secondhand smoke. And Mayor Bloomberg can check to see if the pee beaker is exceeding 16 ounces. Yeah, what a bunch of flunkies. man, you'd never make it in the 50s or the 40s or the 30s. Well, let's see what we got. I did that one last night. We'll do a little love song. It's when guys used to love women.
Let there be light, and there was a light. Let there be earth, and there was earth. If I had my way, I would ask of him, please, let there be you. There be rain, and there was rain. Let there be heaven up above. If I had my way, I would ask of him, please, let there be you. Feeling of spring, you the beginning of dawn. You are the meaning of everything. How could anyone go wrong? Let there be stars, and there were stars. Let there be moon, and there was moon. If I had my way, I would ask of him, please, let there
watching a TV today, and I forget whose show. It might have been Megyn Kelly, and she had Andy Carr on, and I flash back to the classroom where Bush was reading to the children a storybook, and Andy Carr walked up to him and whispered in his ear, World Trade Center in New York, one plane has crashed into it. And Bush continued to read. And shortly thereafter, Andy Carr went up and whispered in his ear again, a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. It's time to get out of here. We're at war. How's that for stepping into Clinton's galoshes? Mr. Party Animal, who kicked the can down the road in 1993, that was the first attack on the World Trade Center. And the Clintons, with the help of the communist press, made fun of the Al-Qaeda who attempted to blow the building up so it could collapse and fall on other buildings. They called them stupid. They called them jerks because they went to get their a refund on their a deposit with only a steering wheel. And they mocked them and they laughed how stupid they were. Yet people died that day in 93, and 100 were injured. And people that were working in the World Trade Center at that time left and never went back. And then along in 2001, on 911, comes two planes to bring down the towers. And the first plane hit, and the people in the other building that was untouched started to evacuate, and some fool told them, go back up, there's nothing wrong. Because they wanted to make sure that the Wall Street opened up on time. Wall Street was more important. And there were guys that were on that second building that didn't listen. They didn't listen to go back. They got out of there. And they were the lucky ones. And we know of somebody who, as the people were making it for the elevator, he had a Chinese a co-worker. And the co-worker was in the elevator, and he pulled him out of the elevator. He says, "You come, we're going down together." And they ran all the way down like 80 flights of stairs. And the people in the elevator were killed. How's that? How's that for a break? You never know. You never know. So, then we fast forward up to today. And I look at the staff that Obama has surrounded himself with to fight this war on terror. And I can tell you with conviction that Bush had a better team. Bush had the best team. He had the best military. Who do you see? Who do they trot out now? Guys that don't even go to war. Admiral Mellon, I call him Admiral Lemon, he's retired. Yet he's the only admiral that you ever see come out and speak. The difference between Bush and Obama, you could say both were incompetent, but one surrounded himself with competent people, and the other guy is surrounding himself with communist friends. And it's going to lead to a lot of dead people. He's already lost 2,500 in Afghanistan. Bush only lost 461 in 8 years. He lost an entire SEAL team. And they covered it up in 24 hours. This media is no good. New York Times is no good. The Washington Post is no good. NBC, I call it nothing but communists. ABC, always be communist. The CNN, the Communist News Network. All of these people are part of the Democrat Party, the party of death. I was talking to somebody today, and I looked at my watch. It was 1 o'clock. I said, "Guess how many American babies are dead by 1 o'clock? And I figured I cut it in half. It was 4,700. I divided it by 2. I says, "This right now, up to 1 o'clock, we've killed 2,000 so many babies. 2,350 babies. And by 5 o'clock tonight, we'll have killed 4,700, and we'll be ready to kill another 4,700 tomorrow. We're killing American babies, and we're letting strangers into the country to take their place. And we call ourselves compassionate. I saw something, somebody sent it to me, 10 pictures of a baby in the womb. Let me see if I can find it. If I find it, I'll describe it to you. Because nobody ever talks about abortion. It's like it's not going on. It's like we live outside Dachau, and we see the smoke coming out of the chimney every day. But we don't talk about it because it's not polite. And besides, nothing's going on there. Right? This is called Mind-Blowing Images. Now I'm just going to describe them to you. Let me see. It's coming up. So bear with me a minute. Aha. Okay. Here's image number one. At just 4 days after fertilization, they're showing a clump of cells, five cells. Okay, they look like powder puffs. Picture number two, at just 5 to 6 weeks of gestation, despite being only a quarter of an inch long, this is a little girl, her nose, mouth, and ears are already taking shape. Her heart is beating at 100 times a minute, almost twice as fast as yours, and blood is beginning to circulate through her body. brain waves have been detectable for at least 2 to 3 weeks already. And you can see the eye, you can see the head, and you can see all the veins in the head. That's at 5 to 6 weeks. At 7 weeks, you can see the brain, you can see the eye, you can see the liver, you can see the umbilical cord. At 10 weeks, all her major body functions are up and running. The kidneys, the intestines, the brain, and the liver are all working. 10 weeks. Her tiny arms and legs can already start to flex. Most abortions in the United States take place about this time. If she's lucky, her mom will love her enough to let her live. And if she's not lucky, a doctor will pull her apart with instruments of torture. At 12 weeks, her muscles are beginning to bulk up, so she's busily stretching and kicking in 12 weeks. If you put your hand on your tummy, she'll likely wiggle in response because her reflexes are starting to develop, although you won't feel it yet. So if somebody goes in with an instrument of torture, she must recoil upon the approach of the pliers that will pull her apart. At 16 weeks gestation, this week the baby is going through a growth spurt. Soon she will be growing locks of hair on her head in 16 weeks, and she's already starting to grow toenails. Every day her heart pumps about 25 quarts of blood through her body. Sucking her thumb at 18 to 20 weeks gestation. Now you can see the facial features. Right about now she has a unique set of fingerprints. So at 18 to 20 weeks she could be fingerprinted and identified. At 6 months gestation, the baby can now respond to external sounds by moving and increasing the pulse. A mother may notice jerking motions if the baby hiccups. Then at 6 to 7 months gestation, you got a baby. You got it. At around 8 months gestation, you can see all the baby's hair. The baby's completely formed. And the umbilical cord, which looks like you're in a spacecraft, you know, and you're outside, you've got the tether. This baby can hear and is beginning to recognize her mother's voice. Her skin is pink, and she's already beginning to get that cute, chunky appearance that newborns have. That extra fat is very important because it allows the baby to regulate her temperature after birth. We're all just grown-up embryos. If you've seen this, you would never hurt a child. Yet people go out of their way to save dogs. It is sad. It is really sad. And one day we're all going to answer for it. You for promoting it and me for looking the other way. Because God knows everything. He sees everything. And if you don't believe in God, then just tell me where the end of the universe is. And how come you don't know where it is? Okay, so that's it. We're going to sign off. If I find another tune, I'll give you a tune before I go. And maybe we'll meet tomorrow. And we'll see who hurts us the most tomorrow. One day we're going to have a day of reckoning, and nobody's going to like the humble pie that we're going to have to eat.
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside.
Party, a book, signing off. Spirit of America Party, radio show.com. Have a nice night.